Welcome to the Center for Lit Academy Library. This discussion of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald is a part of the American Literature Series. I think we should begin our discussion of The Great Gatsby with a little context. This book was written in the 1920s by an American author, and it was written kind of at the height of a period in American history famous for its moral dissipation, famous for excess of one kind and another. You've heard of the phrase the Roaring Twenties.
Or the Jazz Age.
To describe American history in this period, or the Jazz Age. This book was written about this period, and it was also written right in the middle of this period. I think it was published in 1925, even, is dead center in that decade. A couple of details about American life in this period that might be helpful for us to put the book in context. The financial life of the country was booming. The stock market was only 4 years away from that immortal crash that brought on the Great Depression. That happened in 1929. So everybody who's playing the stock market is making money right now, hand over fist. Bankers are getting rich. Rich people are getting richer. Nobody's struggling. There's very little poverty compared to what there would be 10 years later. The country is very prosperous. And going along with this economic prosperity, philosophically in the country, there's a great move away from traditional values and traditional understandings of how things work. 50 years before, the average person would have been a Bible-believing, church-going religionist who believed in a God that controls all the details of the world, and everything is proceeding according to a plan that he explains in the Bible, and you can be sure that things are going to go exactly the way God wants them to go. What happened at the beginning of the 20th century is a couple of philosophical ideas became popular, Darwinism among them, which tried to explain natural processes without any reference to God, and World War I.
Huge, big deal.
World War I came along, killed a third of the population, the male population of England, for example, and people looked up in the wake of that terrible war. They called it the war to end all wars. It was as if the world was ending. They looked up and said, the God who convinced us in the last century that everything was going to go forward according to his kind and good plan, that God either isn't paying attention anymore, has changed his mind about that, or never existed in the first place. And lots of people grew very uneasy with the traditional ways of seeing the world. Among these people who grew uneasy for these reasons were a host of artists and writers and philosophers and intellectuals, the kind of people that look around and ask hard questions about life and about the world and put those hard questions into works of art. And so you will notice, if you read other books written in this period, a similar, what's the word I'm looking for?
Malaise.
Malaise is not a bad word. A similar malaise, a similar discomfort with old verities and certainties.
Same kind. The artists in this period are all asking the same kinds of questions.
They're all asking the same kinds of questions, and they have a bit of a cynical flair to them, along the lines of, you really think there's a God up there? If there's a God up there, he must not be paying attention. And a lot of artists look back to the period that had just preceded, where all those certainties were in place, with wistful longing, as if to say, boy, when we were young and naive, it sure was a more pleasant place to live. So artists take up these questions a lot in this period. Ernest Hemingway is another artist in this period that you may have heard of, asking these same sort of questions, writing books at the same time as F. Scott Fitzgerald. And there are others that belong in the same category. Fitzgerald's work is maybe the most accessible of these, and that's why we tend to assign it, because it's a perfect picture of the philosophical and intellectual state of the Western world in 1925. Mrs. A, you look like you wanted to say something too.
No, I was just wanting to talk about and to remind the students that the classics themselves don't necessarily contain all the right answers. We don't necessarily go to the classics in order to find out the capital T truth. But in so much as the authors of the great classics of Western tradition have faithfully reported the world as they see it, there are some little T truths in it. That is to say, that we can glean from them an understanding of man in particular circumstances asking particular questions, as long as they are asking them honestly and reporting the consequences or the fallout of those questions in their fictitious world, honestly.
Yeah, because when they do that, what's going to happen over the course of a long period of time is that the questions they ask that sprung out of a particular time and place, America in the 1920s, right before the stock market crash, those questions are going to last even when the period of time fades away.
As a matter of fact, those questions were not new to the time period.
Very good point.
People had been asking questions about the goodness and nature of God and the meaning of life and what a man is and those big universal questions since the dawn of time and asked those questions. It's just that when we read the classics, what we find is a running dialogue about those things. And depending on where we dip in and the historical context of that time period and that individual man's thoughts, we're going to find different answers or different contributions about those big ideas.
Yeah.
Because there's so much influence in the culture and in the circumstances of a particular season of the world, we find when we dip into this period, a lot of the same questions being asked and a lot of the same tone in the authors that ask them.
And it comes across, that's a great lead up to this kind of summary sentence. It comes across in the case of Fitzgerald as, not a very moral book, which is what one of our students said in the chat box a minute ago.
And what you got to realize is that he is, to some extent, depicting the world as he saw it at that point in time, at that point in history. And even though it's fiction, he is casting a materialistic world he's basically painting it with a really broad brush so we don't miss the philosophical implications of what he's saying.
Yeah, that's right. That's good. That's a nice little summary of the context surrounding this story. Let's jump in now and talk about the setting of the story, because those two things, as I said, this book was written in 1925 and also set in 1925. So context and setting are going to be very similar in the case of The Great Gatsby. But just raise your hands if you guys would and give me some details of the time and place of this story, the surroundings, the kind of people among whom the story happens. Give me some specifics of setting, if you would. Grace, you first, and then Thomas. Grace, go ahead.
Well, it's set in 1920s New York City. It's in Long Island, correct? East Egg and West Egg, around the rich elite people, but it does take us into the inner city of New York and to maybe less respected establishment like Wilson's Auto Garage and places like that.
Good.
Do you remember what they called that place where the Auto Garage was?
I do not. I could look at the paper that's on my screen.
I left some notes up. Go ahead and say it out loud for the benefit of our recording, Grace.
The Valley of Ashes.
The Valley of Ashes.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, the Valley of Ashes, exactly. And East Egg and West Egg, what are these, East Egg and West Egg?
It's just the two areas on Long Island where the rich people usually hang out, mainly for older rich people and newer rich people, as it were.
Okay, good. Is the fact that they are two separate protrusions significant in the story?
Yes, because it has a separation even among the rich people of the different classes of social elites.
Yeah, different classes of social elites. Exactly right. Is this relevant to our story? Do characters in our story straddle that line between social elites?
Yes. You have the younger ones and the older ones, like Gatsby-ish, kind of leaning towards it. It kind of has the older, more refined people at his parties also crashed by everyone else. But
right. And at one point in the story, and it becomes really significant, Gatsby himself looks across the water, but that separates East Egg from West Egg, right? And what does he do? Calvin?
He reaches his hand out towards the green light across the way.
He's stretching across from one to the other, right? What is that? What's he doing there?
Well, we know what he's doing. He's reaching out towards Daisy Buchanan.
Right.
But yeah, the separation is critical.
Yeah,
to our story.
Right, and we'll talk about how that aspect of the setting is reflected in Gatsby's own goals as we go along. Thomas had a comment.
Before you go on to Thomas, I was just going to suggest that we talk about that green light at some point along the way.
Yes,
the color green and what it might mean.
Oh, for sure.
Pretty significant.
For sure. Thomas, you put your hand down, which I saw. I was just about to get to you, so if you have anything else to contribute, go right ahead. Let's talk some more about the setting of the story. We've got a good idea of the place, New York, 1920s, among the rich, among the poor, every once in a while. Go ahead, Juliet.
Gatsby, the book, it's set, obviously, amongst, like, the Valley of Ashes, Gatsby's house, Tom and Daisy's house, and all of that. But I think an important point is that the book is set in the height, like you guys mentioned, like the height of America, the height of indulgence and abundance, and like who was wearing the shiniest dress and who has the most money, and do we have polo ponies in our backyard? And if so, that means that we have truly made it and succeeded. And so I think that that's the big thing of it being just this overabundance of living to the point where it induces like this just like stagnant way of being in your riches and all of that.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Overabundance and excess and materialism and
debauchery.
Yeah. Very good. I think those are important components of the setting. In fact, a lot of the story's conflict arises out of that situation. Calvin, your hand was up.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about the Valley of Ash or Ashes. Which one is it?
Oh, Ashes. Yeah.
Yeah. They kind of drive through that, and they always kind of hurry through it if they can, except for Tom, whose mistress obviously lives in Wilson's garage. But it's because I think the reason they hurry through it is because of the eyes.
Ah.
The big billboard that has the advertisement on it for glasses or something.
For the like Oculus. That.
Exactly. But Wilson, after his wife dies, comments on the fact that we're all being watched. And he goes to the window and just stares out at
yes.
the eyes.
Yes.
Signifying or maybe indicating in something greater than us, something beyond us. Not explicitly saying God or anything like that, but definitely hinting towards something like that. And it makes Nick super squeamish because of all of the things he's seen, like at Gatsby's parties and things like that.
Interesting.
What do you think the function is of those eyes, really? Do you remember what the author says about them? Let me read to you a passage. It's chapter 2, the first couple of paragraphs when he talks about the Valley of Ashes that you're referring to. It says, about halfway between West Egg and New York, the motor road hastily joins the railroad and runs beside it for a quarter of a mile, so as to shrink away from a certain desolate area of land. This is a valley of ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills and grotesque gardens, where ashes take the forms of houses and chimneys and rising smoke, and finally, with the transcendent effort of men who move dimly and already crumbling through the powdery air. Occasionally, a line of gray cars crawls along an invisible track, gives out a ghastly creak, and comes to rest, and immediately the ash-gray men swarm up with leaden spades and stir up an impenetrable cloud which screens their obscure operations from your sight. But above the gray land and the spasms of bleak dust which drift endlessly over it, you perceive, after a moment, the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. The eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg are blue and gigantic. Their retinas are 1 yard high. They look out of no face, but instead from a pair of enormous yellow spectacles which pass over a non-existent nose. Evidently, some wild wag of an oculist set them there to fatten his practice in the borough of Queens, and then sank down himself into eternal blindness, or forgot them and moved away. Yeah. But his eyes, dimmed a little by many paintless days under sun and rain, brood on over the solemn dumping ground. What do you think that Fitzgerald is implying?
What do you guys think? This is a great aspect of the setting of the story. It's a key detail of the setting of the Valley of Ashes. What's he implying by that description of the billboard of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg? Brenna, your hand is up and we haven't heard from you yet today. Go ahead.
I kind of feel like Dr. T.J. Eckelberg's eyes were, I don't know, almost symbolizing like a watchfulness over the city. You know, especially since like they all kind of thought that God didn't really exist at this point, or they didn't want to believe that he existed. I guess it kind of gave them like a wariness that, yeah, somebody really is watching.
But notice how the author mentions that whoever put that sign there disappeared.
Yeah,
he sank himself into eternal blindness or forgot them and moved away.
I was thinking about the way I described the 1920s attitude toward God at the beginning. The God who was directing everything before World War I must have changed his mind or moved away or didn't exist in the first place.
Either he didn't care or he died or he's never there in the first place. This is sort of the sense that you get of this old sign. So the sign itself is sort of ironic because where is it? Where is it located? What is it peering down over?
Calvin?
It's peering down onto the debauchery of the time.
Well, in particular, the locale that we just read about, this Valley of Ashes, right? So we're not really, I don't think that Fitzgerald is invoking some sort of beneficent God who's paying attention, because in this particular scene, it's peering down over this desolate moonscape of ashes and dirt and dust where the men are described as crumbling,
John
swarming.
Calls it a wasteland in the chat box.
It's a wasteland. In fact, it conjures up images of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, the long narrative poem that would be written in that same century.
Same period even, mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Grace, your hand is up. Go ahead. You have a comment? Grace.
To tie it in what someone said earlier, I find it interesting that the eyes of the billboard and the way Wilson looks at them at the end, like it's God. Clearly it's meant to be some sort of God figure watching over the shady actions of all these characters. But it's also similar to the way that Great Gatsby stares at the green light on Daisy's dock. They're both kind of looking and yearning after something they can't quite have.
Ah, in Gatsby's case, as he reaches after the green light from the end of his dock, what is he yearning after that he can't have?
Daisy and hope.
Interesting. I wonder if
you think it's just hope. Maybe it's also to belong in that particular world that Daisy comes from.
Well, I was going to make a comment about that. What other aspect of this setting have we not mentioned that's actually on the sheet here? Grace, your hand is still up and you're unmuted. What else about this time and place should we mention is going on in this decade?
Towards the end of it, or?
Yeah, I was thinking about that note that's on the screen during Prohibition. Remember, do you know anything about Prohibition?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yes, so alcohol is illegal, and during the time, it was fairly common for crime gangs to form, to sell alcohol, or like speakeasies would pop up everywhere where people would go to drink, and it's illegal, but at the same time, it was a very prominent part of culture.
Yeah, a perfect picture.
And of very lucrative.
The kind of thing we're talking about. And also very lucrative, right?
And for all the rum runners.
Exactly. Yes, thank you, Grace. And that's obviously relevant to our story because the source of Gatsby's wealth, we find out later, is illegal dealings and things like alcohol. Good. Okay, Tom, your hand is up. I'll take a comment from you and then we'll move on. Keep going.
I just wanted to comment on what Mrs. A said about Gatsby trying to fit into the society, because I think that is kind of what he's doing, because we saw before, I mean, he had even changed his name. He used to be, his last name used to be Gats. Was it Jim Gats, I think, or?
Yep.
But yeah, so he's like completely changed his name and his occupation many times. To try to fit in, and I guess you could say to fit in with Daisy as well, to appeal to Daisy, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, I think that he definitely has a overwhelming desire to make something of himself and fit in this new society. We'll talk about how he manages that as we go along. Go ahead, Mrs. A.
You know, it's interesting. He's got such opulent parties and so much money from his illicit, bootlegging that he does. You wonder why he feels he hasn't made it until you realize that in this time period, there was a real distinction made between old money and new.
Hence the eggs, west and east.
Right, exactly. And it didn't matter how much money you had. If your money was new, then the old money people looked down their nose at you. And so he was, in a sense, doomed. He was never going to belong in Daisy's world.
That green light is always receding in front of him.
So let's talk about that color green for just a minute. What do you think it symbolizes? Because this is clearly a symbol. It's a recurrent image in the story. What does green usually symbolize?
Brenna, your hand was up. You put it down. Loss of nerve, I imagine. Oh, there it is. I'm just kidding, Brenna. Go ahead. You're up.
I kind of feel like when Gatsby is looking across the river at the green light, the green light almost like represents his envy a little bit of Tom Buchanan and I don't know, his lack of not being able to get Daisy.
Yeah, he envies what the old money of New York City has, not just in terms of money, but also in terms of belonging and social standing. And of course, he envies Tom for having Daisy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Green is a very significant color in regard to that. Shakespeare called jealousy the green-eyed monster.
Right.
Right. And here it comes up again, that light on the end of the dock that represents everything he can't have, but that he wants so badly.
Yes. Yes. Good. Good comments. Juliet, go ahead.
I think that the green light represents Gatsby's dream, the all-American dream that he has of Daisy and their life together. I think that it, going off of what Mrs. A said, you know, envy and jealousy being a green-eyed monster.
Yeah.
I think it just represents his love and his dream of having her.
Good. I think you're right about that as well. We're starting to get a picture of Gatsby just discussing the setting and some of the symbols. There's one other element of setting that Mrs. A and I like to talk about. It's not often noticed by lots of students, but you may have noticed that this story is set among Midwesterners who have moved east to live in the big city. That includes the narrator, Nick. It includes Tom Buchanan and Daisy, even Gatsby himself. None of them are originally from New York. They come from the Midwest. And does that ever come up in the story? Do you hear Nick, for example, ever meditating on the difference between the Midwest and New York? Do any of the characters ever feel the difference? And what sort of difference is it? Anybody have a thought about that? Calvin?
Yeah, he says, I don't have the book in front of me, but towards the end, he talks about it and talks about the East as having opportunity and being more interesting and more for him because he was, you know, excited to go there. And then towards the end, he's disillusioned in the East and decides to go home to where it's quiet and where there's not as much debauchery and stuff like that. But you get the sense that everyone moved east for that reason, because there are more parties, because there's more to do, more debauchery to be had.
Very good. And so the back west and out in the Midwest is where the old traditional values and lifestyles still sort of thrive.
Exactly. Mm. Maybe interesting. Even the old money.
No, I think this is the passage you were mentioning, Calvin. It's on page 177 in my copy. He says, the narrator says, "That's my Middle West, not the wheat or the prairies or the lost Swede towns, but the thrilling returning trains of my youth and the street lamps and sleigh bells in the frosty dark and the shadows of holly wreaths thrown by lighted windows on the snow. I am part of that, a little solemn with the feel of those long winters, a little complacent from growing up in the Caraway house in a city where dwellings are still called through decades by a family's name. I see now that this has been a story of the West after all. Tom and Gatsby, Daisy and Jordan and I were all Westerners, and perhaps we possessed some deficiency in common which made us subtly unadaptable to Eastern life. Even when the East excited me most, even when I was most keenly aware of its superiority to the bored, sprawling, swollen towns beyond the Ohio, with their interminable inquisitions which spared only the children and the very old, even then it had always for me a quality of distortion. West Egg especially still figures in my more fantastic dreams. I see it as a night seen by El Greco, 100 houses at once conventional and grotesque, crouching under a sullen overhanging sky and a lusterless moon. In the foreground, 4 solemn men in dress suits are walking along the sidewalk with a stretcher on which lies a drunken woman in a white evening dress. Her hand, which dangles over the side, sparkles cold with jewels. Gravely, the men turn in at the house, the wrong house, but no one knows the woman's name, and no one cares. After Gatsby's death, the East was haunted for me like that, distorted beyond my eyes' power of correction. There's that image of the eyes again, right?
Yeah, in, that's recurring.
In such need of correction.
Yeah.
Yeah, a recurring
image. He's basically saying that we don't see the world correctly.
Not in the East. He says, so when the blue smoke of brittle leaves was in the air and the wind blew the wet laundry stiff on the line, I decided to come back home. So, really, the West calls to him. Why? What is the West associated with that the East doesn't have to offer?
And Riley, I've had your hand up for a long time. If you want to answer that question, you are up. What does the West have that the East doesn't have?
Well, I think the West has more freedom, in a sense where there's more room, you know, it's not cramped quarters, but the East has almost has a harsh and hard sense about it. It's very blunt I don't really know how to describe it, but the West has a softer tone, at least the way he portrays it. And the East is just, it's very civilized and there's a lot of scandalism, whereas the West is a lot calmer and the people there are a little more sensible.
Yeah, and you go there and you live for generations in a house that still has the family name.
Yeah,
which symbolizes continuity,
yes,
tradition, stability. The West is a place where that god of that period before the World War I still lives and still watches over things, right?
The East is it's very liberal. Whereas the West seems more conservative.
Okay. That contrast between the two is going to be important, or is important, especially in the speech you just read by Nick Carraway as he's putting the finishing touches on this story. And the fact that that comes at the end, I think, is significant too. Don't you, Mrs. A?
Oh, absolutely. Because remember, the end of the story is the point at which the author is wrapping up to give you his thematic ideas. It's his, basically his last shot at communicating his theme to his readers. So he's redirecting. He's repackaging, he's interpreting for you in the end of the story.
One last element of setting, and then I will submit to go on to characters. At what time of life for the narrator does this story happen? At what time of life for the narrator does this story take place? Caitlin, your hand is up and has been up the longest, but whoop, just put it down. Did I unmute you? Caitlin, do you want to speak?
I'm sorry, what was the question again? I had a different comment.
Oh, okay. Why don't you make your comment first, and then I want to come back to the time of life for the main character that this story takes place. But you go ahead, Caitlin.
Okay. I had something that I was thinking about that I was wondering if we could talk about briefly. There was a quote at the very beginning of the book. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. And it was something that his father told him, that he begins the book with that quote. And I was thinking it was interesting that even though he's in New York where everyone else is richer than him, he kind of considers himself as having advantages that other people don't have.
And what would they be?
Well, I think partly it's from where he was from and the less immorality, I guess.
Yeah, the advantages of that stability that we're talking about, that continuity, that universe of dependable constants that seem to be as elusive as dust in the East. Yeah, that's great. That's a great interpretation of that. And that's Nick that has that going for him, right?
Right, yeah.
So, Mrs. A, go ahead. I'm going to leave Caitlin unmuted because I want to ask her the next question, but you go ahead. Yeah. Mrs. A always likes to talk. Go.
What I was going to say in reference to that quote that you read is, do you think that it's ironic that he makes this comment that he's inclined to reserve all judgments? He spends a long time building up his case about how impartial he is in every way. Does that bear itself out throughout the rest of the story?